toward the end of the Buddha's long night, sitting under the Bodhi tree, and after Mara, the personification of all the dark and obstructive forces in the mind, had let fly at Siddhartha, this about-to-be Buddha, all of the poison arrows of desire, craving, aversion, all of the arrows of what we could call the afflictive emotions. Mara trying to distract Siddhartha from his great resolve that now very famous night. Mara found that none of these arrows stuck into the Buddha, as Mara had hoped they would. And so finally Mara shot the last arrow, this last poison arrow he shot at the Bodhisattva, hoping that this one would really stick in firmly and stick deeply and stay. The last poison arrow of delusion, the arrow of doubt, the arrow of self-doubt. And Mara spoke to the Buddha and said, "What makes you think you have the right to be sitting here the way that you are, doing what you're doing? Just who do you think you are anyway?" said Mara. And this just about to be Buddha, with his great deep confidence, his lion-like fearlessness, and his amazing grace, he just simply reached down and touched the earth with the fingertips of his right hand, letting Mara know that the earth was bearing witness to his right to be sitting where and how he was. And at that moment, Mara was defeated, never ever again to return to the Buddha, or to the just about to be Buddha. It's as though all of us, and the Buddha wasn't excluded from this either, it's as though all of us have skeletons in the closet. The old and sometimes seemingly new angers, fears, judgments, strong desires, confusions, doubts, pains, etc. From our present life's experiences, and carried on from many, many, many lifetimes' experiences. And some of these we may have looked at, and some of these we may have hidden away. In meditation, we open to whatever is there, whatever is here, whatever's present, whatever is arising, including things that we may have tucked away, these so-called skeletons in the closet, when they appear. There are some people, it seems, who are able to find a true, deep contentment without ever letting out the skeletons. And that's just fine for them, whoever they are. But most of us need to discover them in order to
find a true depth of happiness, in order to find a really true deep ease of well-being in our life. Or we continue to delude ourselves into thinking that we can be happy and never really never being so. Meditation allows us to open the closet and to look into the boxes, to uncover what may have been hidden, or that we've hidden from, or judged as unacceptable and buried away. Practice gives us a very powerful tool of open-hearted, non-judgmental, non-manipulative, non-grasping, non-rejecting, receptive presence to be able to see clearly. With meditation, we learn to open to our tools from the high class friendship with ourselves, kindness, compassion. Embody.
No longer need to fix it. Things are just as they are. We leave everything as it is. In our rooms, with all of the boxes opened, the skeletons uncovered, so to say. We can be present in this moment of our life without the old habit of giving the past, be it 10 minutes ago or 20 years ago, continued power over us. This is really a possibility in practice. And it's not a linear process, actually. As we continue to see more and more clearly, we also continue to cultivate this relationship of kindness and friendship and compassion with ourself, for ourself. It's really the whole seamless circle of what we could call heartful spaciousness that allows the clearest depth of the truth to be seen. And sometimes there's a resistance, there's fear to this opening, in relation to this opening. Anxiety, tension, worry is created by and manifests to the degree of the strength of our resistance. Resistance is based in fear. And so this can be kind of a vicious circle. And so we work, we practice with a great gentleness, a great kindness, and a very deep patience for and with ourselves, as we move in and through this process of opening, opening to and letting go of, or we could say relinquishing, our old habitual places of anguish, of confusion, our habitual places of suffering. And this is from Nisargadatta Maharaj. He says, don't bully yourself. Violence will make you hard and rigid. Don't fight with what you take to be obstacles on your way. Just be interested in them. Watch them. Observe. Inquire. Let anything happen, good or bad, but don't let yourself be submerged by what happens. The Buddha, in his first Dharma discourse after he was enlightened, said something that's quite famous now. He said, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. Maybe the most subtle And yet the most deeply pervasive suffering in this life is that which is inherent in ignoring the truth that everything in this world, everything in this universe, comes into being through the combination of a multitude of conditions. Everything. Everything is contingent. Everything is dependent, interdependent. Nothing, no thing arises or originates totally separately from anything else. And I spoke a little bit about this last night. Because of this, that. Because of that, this. Everything is relative, related. Everything is in relationship, an infinitude of relationships, including the arising of anger, fear, strong desires, judgments, sadness, doubts, etc. And yet very often we take the opposite of this truth to be the reality of things, taking our experience and things to be very solidly in place, permanent, taking our experiences and things to be separate and solid happenings, to be separate solid forms in and of themselves, which always eventually create suffering for us and often for others. We hold tightly onto the past. We project into the future, solidifying both of these. And yet life just keeps rolling on and on and on. An amazing and fortunate thing about suffering itself is that it too is a conditional, totally contingent aspect of life. It's not an absolute. Where I live, up in the mountains in New Mexico, during our rainy season, we call it a monsoon season, we have often appearing huge arches of rainbows, and even often double rainbows. A rainbow appears because of particular conditions coming together. There's, of course, just the right amount of moisture in the atmosphere. And the angle of the sunlight is just right. And then, of course, it means one has to be in the right place at the right time and looking in the right direction to see the rainbow. And it all changes very, very quickly. In just moments. Everything in life, including ourselves, all of our experiences of body and mind are like a rainbow. Merely a changing set of conditions that are totally interrelated, totally contingent, and empty in and of themselves. Now, it's quite obvious with rainbows, but not so for most of us with this more solidly appearing phenomena, mental phenomena, physical phenomena, our rainbow body, our rainbow mind. The suffering of grasping on, of holding tight, of trying to grasp on to some appearing thing, or experience, or state of mind, any phenomena, and solidifying it and identifying it as mine, as me, as who I think I am, thinking of things, experiences, all phenomena as alone, all by itself, unchanging entity. Be it material objects, ideas, opinions, beliefs, emotional states, bodily experiences, any of these things, thinking of them as permanent, as though they're permanent, as though they're unchanging, and identifying any of these things as mine, as me, as I, in the process of our life experience, will inevitably bring suffering, confusion, anguish. The nature of life, the way of things, the natural laws, the unfolding of life will inevitably get in the way and frustrate or defeat our efforts to try to cling on and solidify this or that, whatever. Practice gives us a very powerful tool of open-hearted, non-judgmental presence to see clearly, to open the closet, to look into the boxes, to uncover what may have been hidden or what we've hidden from or judged as unacceptable and buried away, these skeletons in the closet that we've been hauling around unconsciously, unwittingly, for a long, long time. And I did mention this last night, we can't be free from something that we don't see, something that we ignore. Ignoring ignorance provides the fertile ground for delusion. What delusion? The fertile ground that delusion needs to sprout, to grow in. But again, fortunately, ignorance and delusion are only impermanent, conditioned, contingent states of suffering. They're not our true nature. They're just two of the many hues of the rainbow. This is a piece by Stephen Mitchell, and it's his version of the myth of Sisyphus. We tend to think of Sisyphus as a tragic hero, condemned by the gods to shoulder his rock sweatily up the mountain, and again up the mountain forever. The truth is that Sisyphus is in love with the rock. He cherishes every roughness and every ounce of it. He talks to it. He sings to it. It has become the mysterious other. He even dreams of it as he sleepwalks upward. Life is unimaginable without it, looming always above him like a huge gray moon. He doesn't realize that at any moment, he's permitted to step aside and let the rock hurtle to the bottom and go home. So, in this spirit of stepping aside and going home, grounded in wisdom and compassion, I'd like to explore with you some of the emotional states of mind based in strong desire and aversion, or what are sometimes spoken of as based in hope and fear, the strong energies of mind, of body, that can sometimes be quite difficult for us and that we may have been hauling around for a long time. And we'll begin with what Siddhartha Gautama ended with, doubt, self-doubt. The root, the contraction of doubt, is often engendered by fear. Fear in the guise of doubt, confusion. We won't attend to, we won't open, we don't want to, or we feel like we can't be with this experience, whatever it is, this moment of life, we can't. In this anguished confusion of doubt, we might feel quite frozen. Sensations in our body, our heart, our mind, contraction, a feeling of being frozen. Or we might feel lost. We might feel lost and confused, caught, not able to take the next step, so to say. The rock is too heavy, it's weighing us down, is what it might feel like. And so we may at this point engage in doubting the situation, taking the doubt out, doubting the person, which often manifests in blaming, judgment, outwardly. Or we may turn it around inwardly, doubting ourselves, which manifests in self-blaming, self-judgment, feelings of unworthiness, all based in fear. Not being good enough, or just simply not being enough. Not being perfect, whatever that means. Probably if we all gave a definition of perfection, we'd have a different idea of what that really means. This is a definition of perfection, maybe a little different than many people think, from Chuang Tzu. The mind of a perfect woman or man is like a mirror. It grasps nothing. It expects nothing. It reflects, but doesn't hold. Therefore, the perfect woman or man can act without effort. Perfection from maybe a different perspective. So sometimes we're caught in this distraction of doubt. Doubt's a great distraction. And believing it. For instance, we might be afraid of the fear, afraid to look directly at it, the fear that doubt's grounded in. Especially when we may have taken a little peek and it's not been very easy. Maybe in the past we haven't had a clear avenue of reflection that was helpful during these kinds of difficult situations, difficult times in our life. This practice, vipassana, insight meditation, insight practice, with its avenue of mindful awareness, is really an amazing tool, very amazing tool for seeing clearly, as you're knowing to some degree, and the inevitable intuitive understanding that very naturally arises. Essentially, we have to do it ourselves. We have to go the way ourselves. With mindfulness. But it's really also quite important and quite helpful along the way to also have a strong, clear help from a teacher, a spiritual friend, some kind of guide, someone who can offer, someone who can be a clear mirror in relation to our practice, in relation to our experiences and our practice. And of course, sitting in a group like this, coming to a retreat, taking classes if they're available for you. Very wise, very skillful parts of awakening, pieces, aids, skillful means to awakening. If we get caught in doubt and we take it on as our primary relationship to our practice, to our life, on a deeper level, we're actually living in and out of fear. We've given in to fear. Let it run us unknowingly. As we get stronger and stronger, seeing more and more clearly with this heart and mind of patience, friendship, care, compassion for ourselves, we find that we can actually begin to open to fear, to really come close to it, and to not be so bound, not be so imprisoned by it, in it, not be shut off to the unknown, shut off to this vastness of possibility. We can begin to acknowledge the presence of fear, accept that it is. It's here. And know that it doesn't need to run our life. It's not who we are. It's not me. It's not mine. I'm not a fearful person. Fear happens because of a multitude of conditions coming together in this moment. A totally contingent, dependent happening. And once we begin to know that, it's clearly not me from this perspective. The Buddha's teaching offers us the possibility of a very different perspective, a different relationship to things than most of us have been trained, most of us have been conditioned into, most of us live in. Fear appears as one of the hues of the rainbow. We begin to lose the fear of fear, and we can begin to be able to look it in the eye. This is a piece that I like a lot, talks about this in a particular way. It's a story from a book called The Fate of the Elephant. It's a Sierra Club book, which I think may no longer be published, actually. We came upon a young male lion and two lionesses. They were working their way toward a Maasai and his herd of cattle. As they drew closer, they began to belly along through the grass, then crouched to eye the cattle. The young male started growling. His tail switched with excitement. He half rose to coil for a running start several times. "We'd better help that man," I said. "No," Tim said firmly. "He knows the lions are there. This is for him to do. He would not want us to interfere." The herder stood staring straight at the cats and slowly raised his spear to a throwing position without once moving his gaze away. From a distance, other herders who had noticed the man's posture drew nearer to watch the standoff, but not too near. They too thought this was for him to do. This was what he had been trained for as a herder. Each time the male lion growled and poised itself, the man would shake his spear and spread his stance a bit. Each time the cat was still, the man was still. Matching the animal's steadfast, golden-eyed stare. The standoff continued for a quarter of an hour. At last, the lions crouched away into a line of thorn scrub. Had the herder communicated the slightest hesitation or fear, I think they would have gone for his cattle in a flash. If these youngish lions hadn't known much about the Maasai when they started, they knew something now. And it might help them survive among people in the future. Facing fear, eye to eye. Fear and anger can color our entire experience. When we're caught in these energies, it seems that nothing and nobody is right. When we're swept away in these states of mind, we often feel quite restless, agitated and restless in our body, in our mind. And it might be quite difficult, or maybe seemingly impossible, to become concentrated, to mindfully explore the experience of the present moment. Explore the experience with this energy, this spirit of discovery and investigation. To practice and to understand, we need to be able to come very close to our experience with this spirit of investigation and exploration, without pushing it away, without pulling away from it, without desiring it to be different. So it's really important to learn to work with these states of mind, states of body. When they're what's present in our field of experience. In the classical Buddhist teachings, anger is likened to a pond that's on top of a boiling hot spring. When we're angry, we can't see far. We can't see clearly. And of course, judging or suppressing or repressing difficult emotional energies doesn't work. It actually blocks and deadens our sensitivities and our awareness, keeping this possibility of purification, the possibility of transformation, at a distance. If we act out our difficult emotions, we actually then strengthen. We're strengthening them. We're reinforcing the habit of them. We strengthen our particular patterns around them. We are watering and fertilizing the seeds of our habit patterns. And also, of course, we can get into a great deal of trouble and create a tremendous amount of suffering for ourselves and others if we act out of great anger or great fear. Within this amazing and great tool of practice, the most direct way to work with these sometimes very difficult and sometimes very strong states, strong energies of mind, is of course to be mindful of them. At times to make them the object of our mindful attention when they arise, when they're in our field of experience. These very powerful energies can become another aspect of our growing, deepening mindfulness. Working with these forces, practicing with these forces, can actually become a source of energy and insight. We can learn to directly observe fear, anger, sadness, desire, jealousy, etc., and begin to understand through our own direct experience with them how they operate in the mind, how they operate in the body, what their natural laws are. As I mentioned today, I think in question or in instructions, emotional states, strong emotional states, are clearly reflected in the body as various sensations. With this intimacy of mindful awareness, we can begin to know the particular textures, the particular flavors, for instance, of anger. We can directly experience the changing, ephemeral, contingent, and selfless nature also of any of these strong emotional states. We can actually learn to experience the extremes of these energies without getting caught up, without getting swept away, without being overcome by them. It's as though we learn to see them clearly. We learn to see through them, just like we see through the colors of a rainbow. When I lived at the meditation center a number of years ago, one of the people that also lived there on staff was someone whose energy was fueled primarily by anger. And she was actually very attached, very identified with her anger. And in fact, she spoke about really liking her anger because she felt very strong. And this, it's a very powerful energy, anger. So she felt very strong and very powerful when anger was there. But unfortunately, she was a very unhappy person, because she was kind of like a porcupine. People would begin to get close to her and then feel that very sharp burn of her anger and move away. So she was a very, very lonely person. And yet she was so identified with herself as an angry person, and so afraid that she would lose herself, as she put it, lose her energy, lose her power, lose the fuel of her life if she let go of her anger. What a dilemma. Very difficult. The degree with which we hold on or try to cling to our experience, the degree to which we grasp onto our experience, this is the degree to which we'll suffer. The truth of the matter is that the strong energy that's present in strong emotional states doesn't disappear. We don't lose it. In clear seeing that's free of ego interest, with a non-self-centered presence that isn't exclusively or predominantly in pursuit of our very own personal advantages, such as power or pleasure or status or prestige or recognition. With a clear, non-self-absorbed, and yet very interested mindful attention, for even just a moment or two, therein lies the possibility of transformation, at least for that moment or two. Transformation of the strong energies of fear, anger, clinging, desire, sadness. I said transformation, not loss of the energy, but transformation of the energy. I'd like to now move and take a few moments and look at the energy of strong desire, greed, clinging, attachment. These states of mind that often define what we think we need in order to be contented, what we think we need in order to be at ease in our life. We very often live our life projecting our hopes, our dreams of fulfillment onto some object, onto some kind of a future, imagined future, what we want to become, how we want to be related, how we want to relate, or how we want to be related to, how we want to be seen, or how we don't want to be seen. This is a practice that I was told was one of Mother Teresa's practices. Someone sent this to me, and I'd like to just read it as it came to me in relation to what I just said. This was a practice, I'm told, that she did up until she died, and she was thought of as a saint by many people. So this is the practice of what some people think of as a saint. Still practicing. And here's the prayer. It's a prayer, a practice. Deliver me, O Jesus, from the desire of being loved, from the desire of being extolled, from the desire of being honored, from the desire of being praised, from the desire of being preferred, from the desire of being consulted, from the desire of being approved, from the desire of being popular, from the fear of being humiliated, from the fear of being despised, from the fear of suffering rebukes, from the fear of being calumniated, which means slandered, from the fear of being forgotten, from the fear of being wronged, from the fear of being ridiculed, from the fear of being suspected. Didn't leave anything out. Very powerful. Practice and acknowledgement and honesty. I read this to a friend of mine, and his immediate response was, "Oh my God, do I have a lot to do?" And yes, we have some work to do. I actually found it quite inspiring. So honest, so present, so truthful with oneself, and so willing to go for it, to look at it and go for it. In the classical teachings, strong desire in the mind is likened to a pond that's been filled with dye. We can no longer see the bottom. Our vision's obscured. The heart, the mind, is clouded when we're caught in the energies of clinging, of attachment, of strong desire. Unawareness of the consequences of blindly, of unconsciously following our desires. And, of course, desire is a very natural human experience. It's what got you here. The Buddha called it the one healthy desire to practice. But if we all blindly, unconsciously follow our desires, we certainly are very likely to hurt someone, hurt ourselves. And we also may become quite dependent on having certain objects of our desire in stay the same. And live in this constant hope for them to remain the same. It's a lot of tension. A lot of stress there. Spending a lot of our time pursuing or trying to recreate the object that's changing, because it will change. It might even be just some particular experience you had in one of the sittings today. And then in the next sitting, you sit there trying to make it happen again. hoping that it'll happen again, missing the present moment. We might think that the satisfaction of any particular desire will give us something that in fact it won't, that in fact it can't. So I think a really good question to ask yourself now and then is, how driven am I by my desires? How driven am I by my desires? Give you a simple example. Sometimes we're really very clearly present with pleasant experience, this pleasant experience of a moment. And sometimes we actually suffer in relation to pleasant experience. A number of years ago, I was teaching at a retreat center in New Mexico that has probably the most beautiful flower gardens I've ever seen. I like flowers and I like the smell of flowers. So walking along the path, and there was a smell coming. I followed my nose right to the flower that the smell was coming from and took it in, breathed it in. Very pleasurable, wonderful. But I couldn't stay there all day. I had something else I had to do. So I tore myself away. It was not quite that dramatic, but I didn't want to go. I, in a sense, tore myself away from standing there, squatting down there and smelling the flower. I really had a strong attachment to the experience. In that moment of feeling like I had to pull myself away because there was something next to be engaged in, it was no longer pleasant. Definitely not. Tension, kind of tightness, contraction. And as I was walking down the pathway, I kept thinking about the smell of the flower and redoing it in my mind, but it wasn't pleasant. I mean, there is a delusion that that's pleasant. There's tension in it. There's stress in it. That wanting a very lovely, beautiful, pleasant experience had turned around into a very unpleasant experience. A lot of suffering. Caught in the grip of our own habitual wanting mind, the grip of our own habitual wanting mind. As we actually begin to see, to experience attachment, grasping, we find out that we're experiencing quite a lot of tension. A kind of stress, a burning. There's frustration, there's confusion. There's actually quite a pervasive delusion that this yearning, that this state of desire, that this attachment feels good. We actually believe that it feels good until we really begin to see it clearly. So ask yourself, how pervasive is this in your life? How pervasive is it? What actually is satisfaction? What is it? Someone said, a moment of the release from tension, pressure, stress, of wanting, is actually satisfaction. In an early Buddha Sutta, in the early Dhamma talk of the Buddha, he talked about everything burning. And this is a quote. He said, the eye is burning. Eye consciousness is burning. The ear is burning. What is heard is burning. Ear consciousness is burning. And he went on like this through all the six sense doors. And then he said, burning of what? Burning of desire, burning of hatred, burning of jealousy, fear, burning of the fire of confusion. In English we have the expression burning anger, burning with desire. It burns. If we take a look. I'd like to, and I have to read this, so bear with me. This is a short piece from a book by Jacques Lucieran called And There Was Light. Jacques Lucieran, it's an autobiography, and Jacques Lucieran was, at the age of 8, was blind, became blind through an accident. And he wrote about his life. This is from when he was young, soon after he was blind, or within a few years. The seeing eye was in me. Still, there were times when the light faded, almost to the point of disappearing. It happened every time I was afraid. If instead of letting myself be carried along by confidence and throwing myself into things, I hesitated, calculated, thought about the wall, the half-open door, the key in the lock, if I said to myself that all these things were hostile and about to strike or scratch, then without exception, I hit or wounded myself. The only easy way to move around the house, the garden, or the beach was by not thinking about it at all, or thinking as little as possible. Then I moved between obstacles the way they say bats do. What the loss of my eyes had not accomplished was brought about by fear. It made me blind. Anger and impatience had the same effect, throwing everything into confusion. The minute before, I knew just where everything was in the room. But if I got angry, things got angrier than I. They went and hid in the most unlikely corners, mixed themselves up, turned turtled, muttered like crazy men, and looked wild. As for me, I no longer knew where to put hand or foot. Everything hurt me. This mechanism worked so well that I became cautious. When I was playing with my small companions, if I suddenly grew anxious to win, to be first at all costs, then all at once I could see nothing. Literally, I went into fog or smoke. I could no longer afford to be jealous or unfriendly, because as soon as I was, a bandage came down over my eyes, and I was bound hand and foot and cast aside. All at once a black hole opened, and I was helpless inside it. But when I was happy and serene, approached people with confidence, and thought well of them, I was rewarded with light. So is it surprising that I loved friendship and harmony when I was very young? Armed with such a tool, why should I need a moral code? For me, this tool took the place of red and green lights. I always knew where the road was open and where it was closed. I had only to look at the bright signal, which taught me how to live. The Buddha's teachings and practices are about finding the place of coolness. This coolness based in deep understanding and wisdom. The place of freedom from burning. The end of restless movement, the restless movement of constant wanting, craving, not wanting, resistance. What is seen is just the seen. What is heard is just the heard. What is felt is just the felt. What is smelled is just the smelled. Mindfulness is kind of like magic. Sometimes it feels like that. But not the magician's magic that's all done with, or that creates illusion and then pulls us into this illusion, this delusion. This magic of mindfulness takes us through the illusion, out of delusion, directly into reality. So, emotional states. There's a teaching in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition that talks about emotional states as being the nourishing mud in which the lotuses of compassion, generosity, sensitivity, and wisdom can take root and blossom. And this is a quote from the Vimalakirti Sutra. Flowers like the blue lotus, the red lotus, the white lotus, do not grow on the dry ground in the wilderness, but do grow in the swamps and mud banks. Just so the Buddha qualities grow in those living beings who are like swamps and mud banks of passions. A little different way of considering this. So the poison, as they're sometimes called, the anguish, the confusion of self-centered existence, are transformed, have the possibility of being transformed into nectar, as it's sometimes called, or Buddha wisdoms. The wisdoms of the Buddha, when the thread of self is pulled out. Strong emotions are, we could say, digested. When they're digested, they transform into wisdom. Without self-grasping, pulling out the thread of self, the energies of strong emotions transform into wisdom energy. Just a few examples briefly. Anger without self, no self-grasping, transforms into a mirror-like wisdom from which appropriate action springs. Wanting, strong desire without self, no self-grasping, transforms into the wisdom of clear discrimination. Arrogance, self-recrimination, what in the Buddhist teaching is called conceit, arrogance and self-recrimination, both conceit. Both of these energies are based in fear, and they keep us bound and caught. Without self, no self-grasping, transforming into the wisdom of equality. Sadness. Without self, with no self-grasping, digests, transforms into the great compassion. And lastly, ignorance, transforming into the boundless, panoramic wisdom of emptiness, resting in the selfless nature of all phenomena, great spaciousness, seeing clearly, knowing, but not holding on to any of the arisings and passings, without self. seeing clearly, being so present in the moment without grasping onto experience, the experience of the moment, is really about letting the great undoing, the great unwinding of our karmic predicaments to happen. These karmic predicaments, the contingent, conditioned filters through which we suffer. It's about resting in the deep silence, resting in the boundless, deep spaciousness, and paying attention, an extraordinary kind of attention in the midst of letting life live through us. The times in practice when we experience a stillness, a peacefulness, they're wonderful gifts. They inspire us to keep going on the path. We sometimes may sit so still in a very deep, peaceful place. What we call and experience as difficult sittings can often be places of very deep learning. It's important to remember this. Both things are here for us. Both. Vipassana practice is balanced in the midst of all that we experience with a growing, deepening awareness of the truth of who we are, of our true nature, which isn't something that we have to strive to try to manifest, but something, or we could say nothing, it just is. It's always here, right this very moment. And I'd like to close with a poem. This is a poem by Roger Keyes. And it's called Hokusai Says. Hokusai was a Japanese painter, and you may be familiar, quite a well-known painting of a great big wave. Hokusai says, look carefully. He says, pay attention. Notice. He says, keep looking. Stay curious. He says, there's no end to seeing. He says, look forward to getting old. He says, keep changing. You just get more who you really are. He says, get stuck, accept it, repeat yourself, as long as it's interesting. He says, keep doing what you love. He says, keep praying. He says, every one of us is a child. Every one of us is ancient. Every one of us has a body. He says, every one of us is frightened. He says, every one of us has to find a way to live with fear. He says, everything is alive. Shells, buildings, people, fish, mountains, trees, wood is alive. Water is alive. Everything has its own life. Everything lives inside us. He says, live with the world inside you. He said, it doesn't matter if you draw or write books. It doesn't matter if you saw wood or catch fish. It doesn't matter if you sit at home and stare at the ants on your veranda, your front porch, or the shadows of the trees and grasses in your gardens. It matters that you care. It matters that you feel. It matters that you notice. It matters that life lives through you. Contentment is life living through you. Joy is life living through you. Satisfaction and strength is life living through you. Peace is life living through you. He says, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Look, feel. Let life take you by the hand. Let life live through you. So let's just sit for a moment.